Nice, very good. I'm just wondering what I should give a talk about tonight. Does anyone have any ideas? Yeah? Sorry? Okay, yeah. I wish I didn't see you there. You were gone. Okay. Sorry? Yeah. There was another one. Okay, that'll do. I'll talk. That was actually something I was thinking of talking about, was something that was related to the conference anyway. So I'll do that. Okay, let's begin. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Aparutate sangamatasa dwara yesotavanto vamanchantu sadhante. Okay, so just last week I was in Indonesia and I was at the Sakyadita conference for Buddhist women, which was held just outside of Yogyakarta, as I found out a little bit too late. Actually, I got a ticket to Bandung and I arrived in the wrong city. But anyway, that's another story. I had a nice train drive from Bandung to Yogyakarta. It was very nice. So the conference on Buddhist women. And as you may have noticed, I'm not a woman, but I do wear a skirt, so I managed to sneak in. These things, this is not really apropos of anything, but many years ago I found out the uses of wearing a skirt, actually long before I was a Buddhist monk, because one time I was with my friend Thisbe and we decided to go and have a drink in this cocktail bar in Sydney. We never used to go to swanky places like that, but we just decided to do it for the hell of it. So anyway, we go up there and we're walking into the bar and they're like, oh, you can't walk in here wearing those jeans. Right? I had black jeans on. No, you can't come in here wearing jeans. So we went out and got in the lift and we said, okay, let's do this. So I took my jeans off and my friend Thisbe took her skirt off and she just had tights on. So I put her skirt on and then we walked back in. She had her tights and I had her skirt on. And they're like, oh, that's fine. We don't have a rule against that. So you could sit down and have a drink. So, when I look back at it, I think, oh, there were these little markers that were indicating this was the path ahead, you know? I didn't realize the significance of it at the time, but anyway. Anyway, so we did this conference, and I have to confess, I was only there for a small amount of time for the conference. I only attended a day and a bit there because I was had too many other things on, but I wish I could have stayed for longer. It was a very remarkable conference. So if anybody's interested to find out more about it, the Sakyadita Women's Conference, they hold them every 2 or 3 years. They actually asked if they could hold one here in Perth. I said, well, after the if you give the committee maybe 3 or 4 years of post-traumatic stress counselling after the upcoming conference, then they might be ready to do another one. Anyway, so, but they do it in different places. 1,000 people go for the conference. It's pretty amazing. Yeah. And of all the conferences I've been to, it's probably the most diverse people from so many different countries, from Bhutan and Bangladesh and Indonesia and Japan and China and all America and Europe and all over. So it's quite a wonderful thing. And one of the reasons for the conference's existence is actually a topic that I was interested to talk about for this evening, was the problem of discrimination and the notion of equality. And of course, the very fact that you have a women's conference, well, you don't have a Buddhist men's conference, unfortunately, because most of the conferences by default are men's conferences. And So, everywhere in the world, in most spheres of life, unfortunately, women don't get equality in Buddhism most of the time. And that's not the only form of inequality, but that's one of them. And it's one of the things that we work quite hard to try to overcome. Both myself, Ajahn Brahm, and many others associated with the Buddhist Society, and we're very proud that we have managed to do quite a lot, I think, to make a big change in this. And it's not an easy thing to do, to try to work for equality. And I remember one of my supporters in Sydney when I was there, when we're doing the Bikuni ordination, who's this Vietnamese lady who said to me, "Bante, if they don't worry, if they kill you, you can just come back and do it all again next time." So that's the kind of the attitude that you've got to have if you're going to be doing these things. It's a long-term thing. And it happens on many different levels in many different ways. And one of the things that happened in the conference that sort of highlighted this, as well as talking about different issues regarding women and the treatment of women, they also had a conference on LGBTQQI. I think I got that right. Is that right? LGBTQQI. Lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, queer, questioning, intersex. And you see, I've been practicing. Yeah? And so this is very kind of innovative and very progressive to have a conference on those topics at a Buddhist conference. Of course, when I say innovative and progressive, of course, at the last global conference on Buddhism, those of you who attended, we had the choir, the lesbian and gay choir, sang at the conference. So the BSWA has been progressive on these issues, as on many others. But it was interesting to have that topic discussed in Indonesia, where, of course, it's a majority Muslim country and where a lot of these issues are quite difficult to discuss in public. And whether by coincidence or not, I'm not entirely sure, but it was the same afternoon that we were discussing that in America the Supreme Court passed their ruling on same-sex marriage. So I like to imagine that it was the influence of Sakyadita that kind of tipped the scales and their judge's decision there. Yeah? And so that was an amazing finding, and I think that, you know, if you followed what happened after that Supreme Court decision, you know, you see there has been a real shift, and I think a very positive shift in society, many countries around the world, including the US, on this particular issue in the last 10 years or so. And then after it hit that turning point, what was interesting was the incredible positive energy that was unleashed by that. Yeah? Even when we were at the conference, and I mentioned this, I happened to be doing a panel on the next day, and so I mentioned that this decision had come through, and there was spontaneous applause right throughout the audience. Everyone was so happy to hear, right, that this one more piece of discrimination, of injustice, had been relaxed, and that we were no longer going to tell people, because you have a different kind of sexuality, that that you can't get married. Well, when I say we, I mean Americans. Not Australians, unfortunately. And hopefully we will be changing in the near future. There was a couple of years ago now, there was a Senate inquiry into this, and they asked for submissions from the community. And I attended on behalf of the Buddhist community. And this is something which was actually discussed, not just my personal opinion, but through the peak bodies of Buddhism in Australia. The Federation of Australian Buddhist Councils has also had a policy of supporting same-sex marriage for a number of years now. And so I was very proud to be able to go to the Senate inquiry and present the Buddhist point of view. And, you know, when I do these things, you know, sometimes I get invited. Another time I was invited to talk about these issues around sexuality and so on. And the first thing that strikes me is, why on earth are they asking a monk about these things? I haven't got a good answer to that question yet. But then it always kind of, when I do that, I feel, honestly, when I listen to the conversation and I listen to the reasons and arguments that are being brought forward by different people, I think to myself, I am so glad that I'm a Buddhist. I am so glad that I'm part of a community and a philosophy and a tradition where loving kindness and compassion is unquestionably at the center. Right? And where we are not trapped by all of these kind of silly ideas that all of the confusions and contortions that we try to do to justify things. remember at this Senate inquiry, there was a couple of bishops, Anglicans and Catholics. This was in Sydney, so the Anglicans and Catholics in Sydney are very conservative. Well, the leadership of them is very conservative. Whether the people are is a different matter, but the leadership is. So these bishops were presenting the, you know, there's one and only one kind of marriage, you know. It was Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve, and this kind of thing. They didn't actually say that, but that's more or less what they were saying. But what was interesting was that there was also a presentation from the Jewish community, and it was represented by the progressive Jews. And he made a very good point. And one of the things about the Jewish Christian relations you have to understand is that the Jews usually get a little bit annoyed at the way that Christians treat what they call the Old Testament, right? Because if you're a Christian, you've got the kind of the Bible, but then if something comes up in the Old Testament that you don't like, then you're like, oh yeah, that's just the Old Testament, right? But of course for the Jews, and that's their scriptures. So anyway, so when the Christians sort of said, oh, it's got to be Adam and Steve, then this Jewish fellow said, well, actually Adam and Eve weren't married. Right? Right? Interesting, huh? Adam and Eve weren't married. So if we are to take that story seriously and literally, then it's an encouragement that you don't have to get married at all, right? That's really what it's about. But what that shows you is that, of course, these, you know, we all the time, we over-determine our ancient scriptures, right? We try to make them say things that they never meant to say in the first place, right? So, of course, the person who wrote the story of Adam and Eve was not thinking about marriage equality in Australia, right, in 2015. I mean, it's completely absurd, okay? They were writing a story about creation. They weren't trying to say there has to be one and only one form of marriage for all societies for all time. And so we take our scriptures very often and we over-determine them. We make them say things that they never really meant to say. So in the Buddhist tradition, and at this Senate inquiry, they actually explicitly asked us to refer to our scriptural authority. That was what they were mostly interested in, right? Because I think they'd had a lot of community input from different people. So what they wanted to hear from us was, what's your scriptural authority? And so I was very, you know, happy to say, because as somebody, you know, my field of expertise is study of the early Buddhist texts. And in all of the early Buddhist texts, there's no sign of any discrimination against gay people or lesbians or people because of any different sexuality. And the important thing is that when we talk about kamesu micchachara, the sexual misconduct, the crucial thing, as with all Buddhist ethics, is who gets hurt, right? That's the problem, right? In sexual relations, you share and you are close and you are intimate and you open up to people, and people get hurt when they get betrayed, right? When they get double-crossed, when all of these things. And so you become very vulnerable. And so that the sexual ethics in Buddhism is about trying to manage that. So there's always going to be heartache, right? We know that. It's never going to be perfect. But at least we try to manage it so that people are honest with each other, okay? That they don't betray each other. So that people are kind and respectful to each other. These are the things which are important in sexual ethics, right? Not is it the man and woman or what position you're doing it in or all of these kinds of things. It's so weird, right? These people seem to spend so much time thinking about what other people are doing in their bedrooms, right? And so worried. They're so anxious in case they might be having more fun than they are. Oh. And that's not what it's about, right? I mean, it's about things like kindness, like no violence and domestic violence, right? It's a terrible problem, right? It's very, very terrible. And of course, in Buddhist communities, like in any other community, it's an issue, and we have to open it up. We have to talk about it, and we have to address it, right? And so it's never right. Basically, from a Buddhist point of view, it's never right to hit anybody else for any reason, right? Especially in a marriage situation, right? And so violence of any kind it's just not on from a Buddhist point of view, right? So this idea that, you know, you can discipline your wife or something like that, no, right? It's just not. The Buddha's texts are so many times in the suttas, you know, he's laying down the rod and the sword, you know. It's never right to solve problems with violence, yeah. And so in approaching these issues, so we in the suttas, in the early Buddhist texts, we have discussion of dozens, if not hundreds, of different kinds of problems, moral issues, and so on and so forth. And the issue of same-sex, you know, same-sex issues, it simply doesn't occur. It's just a non-issue, which is not to say that the early texts are ignorant of it. Okay. Those issues are discussed, but they're not discussed in the suttas, where the Buddha gave his teachings, right, which is about what right and what's wrong, but they're discussed in the Vinaya. And the Vinaya is the set of Buddhist texts which deals with monastic discipline, right? So it's about the lifestyles of the monks and nuns. So, of course, of the monks and nuns, we're people who've chosen to live a celibate life. And but, of course, as human beings, and sometimes, well, it doesn't quite work out the way that we wanted it to. And so the Vinaya discusses a lot of different cases, discusses many different kinds of issues, but some kinds of issues it discusses are to do with sexual conduct, and where monks or nuns are messing around and various kinds of things that are discussed there. And I could go into a lot of very exciting and occasionally disturbing detail about those matters, but you'll be glad to know that I won't. But I will just say that in those texts, same-sex, when it happens, is treated basically completely matter-of-factly, right? It's not differentiated in any way, right? It's just kind of normal, right? If a monk has sex with a woman, then he's committed an offence and he has to be expelled. If a monk has sex with a man, then he's committed an offence and he has to be expelled. It's just treated in exactly the same way, right? There's no kind of moral difference between the two. And in fact, not only are same-sex issues treated in the Vinaya, but trans issues are also treated explicitly in the Vinaya. And there's a very interesting passage in the Vinaya where the monk wakes up one morning and finds out that he's turned into a woman. Now, I'm not entirely sure whether this actually happened or whether it's the result of some question asked by some novice at the back of the Vinaya class. Excuse me, Bhante, but what happens if, right? And then they have to make some ruling about it. But it is quite widely found in a number of the different Vinaya texts. And so the monk woke up, he turned into a woman. He goes to see the Buddha and says, Bhante, you won't believe this. I've turned into a woman. And so the Buddha says, okay, well, you go over to the bhikkhuni section. Okay, you become a nun. So this has sometimes been proposed as a means for restarting the bhikkhuni ordination, right? So if the bhikkhuni lineage has really died out, right, all we have to do is find a willing monk. Quick snip and tuck, and away you go, right? Fortunately, we've managed to find other ways of doing it, so we didn't need to actually go that particular road. So, and the Buddha not only says go over to the bhikkhuni section, but he says you keep the same precept you had before and you keep the same seniority you had before, right? You keep the same number of wasa, right? So your ordination from the time that you're a bhikkhu remains valid in your bhikkhuni ordination. And the same thing, when a bhikkhuni woke up, she found out she was a man, and the same thing, she went over to the monk section and so on. So regardless of whether these things actually happened or not, that's not really the point. The point is that when they're treated in the Buddhist texts, they're treated in an entirely matter-of-fact way. It's merely a matter of pragmatics. How do you actually organise these things? What do we do? It's just a procedure, that's all. And so, that gives us a very, very nice example of of how, as a Buddhist community today, and we're facing these issues, have been brought up in our society, and they've been discussed in issues in countries all around the world. It's not just a Western issue, and you go to different countries, and they will be familiar with the issues. And, you know, obviously because there are gay people everywhere, right? I mean, you know, it's not just a Western thing, yeah? And it's not just an other thing, right? So we look at, it's not an other thing, right? We look in the room today, there are gay people, there are lesbian people, there are, I don't know, maybe trans people or people with different sexualities here in this room, and there certainly are a lot more who are watching it online and so on. And so it's not a them, it's a we. Right? It's about it's everybody. It's all of us. It's your friends. It's your neighbors. It's maybe it's you. So when we're dealing with these things, we have some very nice and very pragmatic examples from the Buddha's texts that show us how, that give us some indications of how to do these things. But notice that they're not kind of fixing a response, right? So there's nothing in the Buddha's text that says you have to do it this way and you can't do it another way. Right? But it's giving us an example which we can learn from and which we can use our own wisdom to figure out what's the right thing to do. And to me, this is a very very beautiful thing, a very powerful thing about being part of a religious tradition. And a couple of weeks ago, hopefully most of you were aware when Pope Francis made his encyclical on climate change. And this was another thing which is, I think, for me was very inspiring to read it. It's very, if you haven't read it yet, I strongly recommend it. It's very, very nicely written, very, very sort of easy to read, very friendly to read. And one of the things which really struck me when I was reading that was that there were so many things in there which were quite radical, and I actually had the chance to discuss this with a Catholic theologian, and he said this is the first encyclical that ever uses inclusive language. It's addressed to men and women. It's the first encyclical which widely quotes from bishops and from people all around the world, right? So it's inclusive on a global level. And it uses a kind of an informal language. It's also the first encyclical that ever quotes favourably from people who aren't Catholics. They quoted from an Orthodox source and also from a Muslim. And so in that way, Pope Francis is, I think, you know, very, very powerfully and very beautifully, you know, making his message much more inclusive, relaxing some of the kinds of discrimination which, unfortunately, his church has become known for in the past. And speaking what seemed to me to be much closer to the message of Jesus himself. And we know that Jesus, like the Buddha, one of the things he did was to come to reform his religion and to open it up and to bring those values of loving kindness and compassion to the heart of his religious message. And yet, it seems there's this kind of almost irresistible force in religious communities that will sort of leech out all of the good bits from religion, and all of the love and all of the kindness and all of the wisdom gets squeezed out, and all of the rules and the intolerance and the hardness and everything get placed there. It's very hard to resist that. And in his encyclical on climate change and his focus on the underprivileged, the focus on those who are most in need, his focus on those who are most at danger, it seemed to me that the Pope was going back to speak much closer to the roots of what Jesus was talking about as compared to you know, what we might be more used to hearing. So we have to do the same thing in Buddhism, right? That even though the Buddha's message was very clear and the Buddha's teaching on loving kindness, it could hardly have been more clear or more explicit. How many times in the suttas was the Buddha saying, Sabbe satta, bhavantu sukhitata, may all beings be happy. Right? Sabbe sata, what a beautiful phrase, yeah? All beings. Right? And it's not as if this is something marginal and peripheral. It's not as if this is something which is just mentioned here or there in a this is absolutely foundational to everything that the Buddha taught. Yeah? The first precept in Buddhism, Panatipata Viramani, I'm not going to kill any living being. Right? That's how central it is. And when the Buddha explained that precept in more detail, he said, you lay down the rod and the sword and you live with your heart full of compassion for all sentient beings. That's how you keep that precept. So when we are discriminating, if we're discriminating against people of different sexuality, if we're discriminating against women, if we're discriminating against people of a different religion or of a different race, then is that what we're doing? Do we have our heart full of loving kindness and compassion at that time? I don't think so. I think our heart has become small. It's become hard. It excludes. And it's that heart which excludes and which becomes narrow. And this is where all of the joy drains out of the spiritual life. It's where all the energy gets squeezed out. And this is why, you know, we saw when the SCOTUS, when the Supreme Court made their ruling on same-sex marriage, that was the emotion, wasn't it? You could look in Twitter and all of these things. You know, what did they do? They painted the White House with rainbow colours and all of these kinds of things. It was joy, right? There was so much joy everywhere. Joy is what happens when you stop discriminating. Joy is what happens. Joy is the consequence, right? And it doesn't matter whether it's marriage or anything like that. I mean, actually, you know, you'd think that the conservatives would be very happy because this has actually made marriage a progressive issue, right? I mean, 10 or 20 years ago, progressives in society, Western society, couldn't care less about marriage, right? Marriage is becoming irrelevant, right? And now it's become something which is a progressive issue. So it doesn't matter that that's the issue. It could be anything. But it's something that leads to joy. And this is something which is very, very powerful and very basic in Buddhist philosophy, in Buddhist psychology, okay? The philosophy of Buddhist ethics is that what is kusala, what is wholesome, right, is what leads to happiness. What is unwholesome is what leads to suffering. So there's this link between what's right and what is happy. Yeah? And when you see that happening, when you see that joy that comes when that discrimination comes to an end, then you know that something wholesome has happened, something kusala, something skillful. And this actually was an idea that I had learned a few years ago now. From a lady called, just trying to recall her name, Alison Goodwin, if I remember correctly. Forgive me if I've misremembered. Anyway, but she wrote, I had email correspondence with her a number of years ago, and she wrote a very nice essay on this topic of discrimination, and this was essentially the argument that she was making, that in Buddhism, what is kusala is said to lead to what is happy. What is akusala, what's unwholesome, leads to sadness. But she added to that, and what she brought to that argument was a very extensive discussion of the psychological research into this, and psychological research which has proven, with beyond a shadow of a doubt, that discrimination does lead to unhappiness. Right? It's not just a suggestion or an idea. It's an actual reality. It's an observable, measurable, repeatable fact. If you introduce discrimination into a group of people, the amount of happiness goes down. It's as simple as that. And many of you may be familiar, the classic experiment that was done with this was the classic brown eyes, blue eyes experiment. Is everyone familiar with the brown eyes, blue eyes experiment? Yeah? Many of you, yeah? I think maybe it's perhaps not so well known in Australia as America. I think in America they might show it in the schools, but in Australia I didn't find out about it until some time ago. Anyway, if you're not familiar with it, when you get home, look it up on YouTube. Just go Brown Eyes, Blue Eyes, and you'll see the various clips. And it's a beautiful thing. You can't repeat it by talking about it. You actually have to see it happening. But what they did was that they did an experiment with some school kids, and they basically, the teacher told them that who's got brown eyes and who's got blue eyes? And they said, okay, today brown eyes are bad and blue eyes are good. Okay? And then the next day they swapped it round and said, brown eyes are good and blue eyes are bad. And it was amazing to see the change that just doing that made in those kids. But what was even more amazing is to just see how happy they were when the teacher at the end said, okay, forget about it, now we go back to normal. And the kids, there's just this joy came up with those children. They no longer had to be trapped in this discrimination. Yeah? It's just unbelievable. But this is what we're doing in our societies. And we see that in the Buddhist text, in the Buddha's day, one of the most predominant and pernicious forms of discrimination at that time was not actually discrimination on the basis of sexuality. Okay, that's not really an Indian thing. What was predominant at the time was discrimination on the basis of caste. And so this is something that the Buddha raised up, made very central, and made a very strong argument about. And he said that people are not distinguished on the basis of their caste, they're distinguished on the basis of their behaviour, their karma. And he actually makes a pun on this, because the word karma in India essentially means action, but it can have a number of nuances, as those who've been to the Karma and Rebirth course would know. One of those, people say that you're distinguished because of your karma, means what you've done in your past life has meant you've been born in this particular state in this life, right? But actually the ordinary everyday meaning of karma is to work, right? It's what you do, right? And so the Buddha used a pun on this. It's not your karma which determines who you are, it's your karma, right? It's not what you did in your past life that determines, it's what you choose to do now that determines you. Okay, so our identity, who we are, is shaped by how we live. And so the Buddha was quite sort of scathing in his dismissal and his critique of the Brahmanical claims to superiority on the basis of caste. And of course, this is something which is probably even more essential for Buddhism today in India. Of course, there are many things that we find within in Buddhist traditions that we find. For example, it's quite common that people will say that if you're a woman, you're born as a woman because of your bad karma in your past life. Now, some of you are smiling. You're laughing. It's so ridiculous. Yeah. I was actually I did a class in a girls' school in Sydney a few weeks ago in St. Hilda's. And terrific class, actually. And they were discussing various issues like this. And I asked them, what would you do if somebody told you that you were born as a woman because of your bad karma? And they said the same thing. They said they'd laugh at them. Yeah. But that's, interestingly enough, that's kind of not too dissimilar from what the Buddha himself did, right? And it's very noticeable that in the Buddha, in his conversations with the Brahmins, okay, so remember the Brahmins were like the really stuck up ones, right? They were the kind of the aristocrats, they were kind of really kind of up themselves, right? They thought they knew it all. And one of the means which is used most commonly in the suttas to kind of deflate the pretensions of the Brahmins is humour. Okay, and the Buddha could be a little bit snarky at times. Okay, a little bit snarky at the Brahmins, yeah, and he's kind of deflating their pretensions. And you know, so for example, just trying to think of one off the top of my head, where the Buddha tells the story about Brahma who's supposed to have known everything. And his monk had this question that nobody could answer, and he went up to the Brahma world and he asked Brahma, the answer to this question, and Brahma said, I am Brahma, the great Brahma, the maker, the creator, the father of all that have been and shall be, and all of these beings were created by me. And the monk says, that's very good, but I didn't actually ask you whether you are Brahma and the great Brahma and so on. I asked you this question, if you could answer it for me. And he goes, I am Brahma, the great Brahma. And so eventually the monk, literally, it says that the Brahma took the monk by the hand and took him to one side and said to him quietly on one side, well, look, actually, I don't know the answer to your question, but all of these other gods and stuff, they think I know everything. So, you know, if you just sort of be a bit discreet with this one. And actually, you should have asked the Buddha. He's the one who's going to answer your question. So, you know, go and ask the Buddha. So this is how the Buddha kind of related to it, you know. And this actually is telling us something very important, because one of the ways that these injustices are perpetrated, okay, right, is because of the intense seriousness with which people take these discriminatory principles, right? And you think, oh, it's not just that I don't like same-sex marriage, okay, but God doesn't like same-sex marriage, all right? And all of these people around the world who claim to be able to speak with the voice of God. I mean, it's bizarre, right? It's nuts, in fact. It's complete. I mean, if it was one person who did that, right, then they're crazy, okay? But if it's a million, it's a world religion, right? I mean, you can't claim to speak from the point of view of God. This is completely crazy. And so if you're, you know, a genuine practitioner in those religious traditions, will always speak from a point of view of humility, right? I mean, you have your scriptures, you have your experiences, your beliefs and things, and then you try to interpret those with as much wisdom and compassion as you have. But you don't say, you know, I know what God thinks. This is crazy. Right? So this is, I think this is one thing, is that we shouldn't take these voices too seriously. We should understand that this is just where they're coming from. Right? And this is the same thing within Buddhism. You know, we can hear that these kind of voices saying these things, women are, you know, if you try to start if you restart bhikkhuni ordination, then you're going to go to hell, right? This is quite a common one. Have you heard that one before? No. If you ordain nuns, then you go to hell. Yeah, I know, it's pretty scary. I mean, this is quite common. I know one nun who was going to become a bhikkhuni, and she went to talk. There was one monk she went to tell, and she told him she was going to go and take bhikkhuni ordination. And the monk said to her, "If you take bhikkhuni ordination, then you will go to hell." Very friendly. And her response was, "Bhante, the only reason why I'd be going to hell would be to visit you." That's the kind of nun that we need in Buddhism, right? So this is how crazy it gets sometimes, you know. And one of the panels that we heard from in Sankhya-dika, I was very honoured to share a panel with a monk from Bangladesh, and he was there with a small community of very wonderful nuns who were living there in Bangladesh. And the monk said that he was... nobody knew he was at the conference, right? He couldn't tell any of the other monks that he was there, right? Because the monks had tried their best to stop this nuns' ordination, and they'd done everything to try to prevent it, and including that they'd sort of basically refused them to hold the ordination in any of the temples. So they'd went round and they just, you know, couldn't go anywhere until eventually they did the ordination. They had a Muslim friend who said, please come to my land and you can do it here. So they did the ordination on the Muslim friend's land. Yeah. Again, you know, I have to say, I mentioned before when I was talking about the bishops in Sydney and saying, well, you know, often the bishops are very, you know, they have this very kind of hard line attitude. Certainly in Sydney they do. But that doesn't necessarily represent the people. And this is, of course, the same here. And, you know, I've met many Bangladeshi monks in my years as a bhikkhu, and they've always been wonderful. And they've had so many who've had really strong support for nuns. Right? It's not as if sort of Bangladeshi monks have something against nuns. It's just not the case. In fact, I remember, I'll just tell you one story. We had a number of years ago, we were doing some chanting at the Bodhi tree. And I went for a few years and we did this big chanting ceremony, chanting the Pali Canon at the Bodhi tree in India, in Bodh Gaya. And of course, as you'd expect, they set up a big place under the Bodhi tree for all the monks to sit. Right? And I go along and say, "Where are the nuns sitting?" And they're like, oh, yeah, we didn't kind of think of that. Oh, they can sit over there with the lay people. And No. We have to find a proper place for the nuns to sit. And so it was actually some Bangladeshi and Indian monks who I was with at the time. And so they were very amenable, and we said, okay, well, what we'll do. And so anyway, we worked out a place, and we found a place to sit for the nuns to sit next to the monks under the Bodhi tree. And so it all worked fine. And so, you know, my personal experience with monks from Bangladesh was that they had been very supportive and very amenable to try to go the extra mile to do something to help support the nuns, right? That's what the monks were like. But somehow, I don't know, as you sort of go up the hierarchy and as people get more power and more prestige, longer titles, I think that's the main thing, is these titles that monks get sometimes, they're so long. And your mind gets harder, and it becomes the compassion and the love and the reason why you're there seems to get forgotten. And so somehow these rulings come down, but are very cruel, and they don't help anybody. They don't accomplish anything. What does that accomplish to tell women you can't ordain? What do you actually achieve by that? It's madness, right? It's complete madness. All I want to do is live a simple life and teach meditation. The leading nun in that group is one of the leading meditation teachers in Bangladesh, right? That's all they want. She goes to the schools and teaches to the kids how to meditate and be mindful. Well, what are you stopping, right? What are you saving by doing this? It's madness. Right? And so we each time as we go in our society, each time as a community, that we can learn to let go a little bit. We can learn to love a little bit more, right? Then we're going to find that joy comes into our heart. Right? Maybe there's some fear there, right? There's a fear of change, right? Fear of the unknown, fear of something which is unexpected, okay? And this is what people will say, you know, what's going to happen? They don't know what's going to happen. What's next, right? What are we going to be legalizing bestiality next? Are we going to be, you know, I mean, this is very crazy things people say. So people have this fear, right? And a lot of the time in Buddhism, what we find is that a lot of times people are very reluctant to rock the boat. They don't want to say anything that's going to upset the monks, okay? And they think they'll have bad karma from upsetting the monks or criticizing the monks, okay? It's something we talked about in the Karma and Rebirth course this last week. But just for your information, right, in the Vinaya, the disciplinary code for the monks and nuns, many, if not most of the rules in the Vinaya were actually prompted initially by the complaints of the lay people. Okay? So the lay people would whinge about the monks. Why are those monks doing that? Blah, blah, blah. Or the nuns, they complain about the nuns equally. Completely fair whinging, right? No discrimination in the whinging category there. And they'd whinge about the nuns or the monks. And the Buddha would ask, is this true? Did this happen? And if it was true, and if it was something that was, you know, a genuine complaint, then the Buddha would lay down a rule. So it's because of the lay people that the monks have so many rules. Thanks, lay people. That's just terrific. Right? And not a single time in any of that process did the Buddha criticize the lay people for making the complaints. Okay? This is not just once or twice this happens. It's dozens of times. Okay? And the Buddha never gives a word of criticism against the lay people unless, of course, it's a deliberate lie which is said maliciously in order to harm the Sangha, which did happen occasionally, right? But if it was a genuine complaint, even if it was mistaken, then the Buddha would never criticize the lay people for making the complaint, okay? So this is something that as a Buddhist community, we have to be able to criticize each other. We have to be able to listen to each other. And this is always regarded as a blessing in Buddhism, okay? Somebody who gives you good criticism at the right time and in the right way, Venerable Sariputta says, when somebody can criticize you, you should follow them like their own shadow and you should never leave them. You should regard them as a treasure. All right? That's how our response should be to people who are going to criticize. But of course, to criticize means to do it in the right way. It means to do it with a mind of kindness and love, right? Not out of anger. It means doing it at the right time. Okay? Right? What does at the right time mean? At the right time means that you talk to that person and you say, there's something we need to talk about. What would be the right time? And you ask them, what is the time that's appropriate for them? You don't dump your stuff on them, right? Oh, what would be the right time? And then when you discuss it, you don't use kind of passive-aggressive accusations and all of these kinds of things, but you just explain what happened. And then you say, this is what happened, and this is how I feel about it, and you move towards a solution. And so usually criticisms and things, it's not a big deal, right? It's okay. It's not nice to be criticized, but it's all right. You get over it, as long as it's done in the right way. And so we should always, in our community, we shouldn't be afraid to be able to criticize if the Sangha is doing something wrong. It's okay. We're just people. We do things wrong sometimes. It's all right. And there are some decisions which people make and things people do that you might agree with or don't agree with, and it's okay. It's not like a heresy or something like that. You don't have to be scared of disagreeing or having a different point of view. And it's one of the nice things, you know, for me living in Bodhnyana Monastery and, you know, to live with Ajahn Brahman, he's very much like that. And it's okay. We can have a different point of view, you know. And Ajahn Brahmali usually has a different point of view than Ajahn Brahman. They argue all the time, you know. I sit in between them. It's like sitting between a bickering married couple sometimes. See, but I can say that, right? They might hear that I've just said that, right? Ajahn Brahman might hear that I've just said that and he'll say something. But I'm not going to get in trouble for saying that. It's okay. Yeah? And in the past, I've had very serious disagreements with Ajahn Brahman about some things. It's all right. You know, he would never hold a grudge. He would never hold anything against me. So it's okay to have different views. It's okay to have different opinions and these kinds of things. We need to discuss them. And even though as a society and as a community, we have advanced in some ways. You know, we do have opportunities for women to ordain now. We have the wonderful nuns monastery at Dhammasara and many other places that we've managed to start and to develop. But it's only the beginning. Yeah? And there are many other areas that we need to look at. One area, I might just raise this up for you now just as a bit of kind of promotion, but I started a couple of weeks ago, I started a hashtag on Twitter, Faces of Meditation, okay? And so this is something I'm going to encourage you all to do, Faces of Meditation. What is that about? Well, if you go to Google and you just go to Google Images and you Google meditation, right, what you find is that everybody who meditates is white, slim, young, pretty, mostly blonde, mostly female, and mostly sitting meditation on beaches and mountaintops. And a lot of silhouettes for some reason. I don't know what the thing is with silhouettes, but there's lots of silhouettes, right? And it's kind of crazy, right? And if you try to find images of people who are meditating who are old and fat and ugly like you lot, then... then it's very hard, right? Really. So I started a hashtag, Faces of Meditation, and we just did a few when I was in Sydney. I just managed to do it, just one meditation session. I might see if we can do it tomorrow afternoon at the meditation if we can. But just take photos of people while they're meditating and just upload it to Twitter. And you put the hashtag Faces of Meditation and you see actually it's different people. And old people meditate and young people meditate and you know, disabled people meditate and so on and so forth. And this, you know, this is another thing. It's a problem in the way that meditation and Buddhism is marketed, right? Because as you can see, I mean, the people here, it's actually a very diverse audience we have of people coming here to listen to the talk and to practice Dhamma. So the people practicing Dhamma around the world is a very diverse audience, but the way that's represented is not always that way. If you're interested to follow up those issues more, then I can highly recommend Angry Asian Buddhist. If you haven't read the Angry Asian Buddhist blog, just giving a shout out for the Angry Asian Buddhist, then they've got a terrific blog where they talk about a lot of these kinds of issues. Yeah. So what kind of discrimination are we still holding? Right? What's next? Yeah. Who is our heart still hardened against? Right? We shouldn't be, you know, this is not something which is we shouldn't feel superior or better because, you know, we understand these issues or we've gone beyond certain kinds of problems, because usually there's something else. Right? It's a continual process. And we don't know about the way that what we're doing, the choices that we make, we don't know how the choices that we make create suffering sometimes until it's pointed out to us, or until we see later, until we can reflect, until sometimes we can see the consequences. Yeah? And sometimes the consequences are very indirect. Yeah? And yet they're still very powerful. Right? Just because they're indirect doesn't mean that they're weak. It means that they're subtle. Sometimes the indirect consequences can be the most powerful. And so I think that this is something that, you know, if we need to bear in mind always, that ideal of the Buddha, sabbe sattā bhavantu sukhitātā, may all beings be happy. You know, always keep that in mind, all beings. And then we'll ask, look around and see who's excluded, where is my love, my loving kindness, where has that failed? Where do I need to work? Where do I need to look at? You don't see those things as a problem, right? It's just the next stage in the journey, that's all. So the world that we live in is deeply unsatisfactory. It always has been, it always will be. Buddhism is not a utopian philosophy. We don't think that we can create a perfect society here on earth or anything like that. But we can make it a little bit better. We can make it a little bit more loving. We can make it a little bit more caring. We can think a bit more about those who are in need, but a little bit less about ourselves. And if we've done that, then we've managed to manifest Buddha's teachings in a practical way. Not just for our own benefit, but for the benefit of others as well. So this is my talk for you this evening, and I offer that for your reflection. And if anyone has any comments or questions, be most welcome. Thank you. Okay, so we have some questions from the internet. Okay, so number one question. Okay, fairly predictable question. Okay, somebody wants to know more about this spontaneous sex changing thing. Okay, so obviously not interested in the whole loving kindness, happiness for beings kind of thing, but spontaneous sex change is like, what the? Okay, well, it's a passage that mentions one. It's once in the Vinaya. I believe, and I think I read many years ago in an anthropology book, I believe that there's a tribe in Africa where they have a spontaneous sex change at puberty. Is that right? Anyway, I did read that once. There's a particular mutation that causes that to happen. Anyway, whether that's the case or not, I don't know. One of the things you have to understand when considering these things from the Vinaya is that You see the Vinaya, we call the monastic code for monks and nuns, is a very highly structured document, and it contains parts which are fairly clearly stratified by age, right? There are certain parts which are very old and many other parts which came from a lot later. And a lot of those parts which are a lot later are highly artificial in style. So they're more in the way of sort of considering hypothetical cases or possibilities than they are in terms of sort of direct historical accounts. So I would take that particular account in the Vinaya as being more likely just a sort of a theoretical discussion of what would happen if this happened, rather than being a kind of a literal evidence for this having happened. But perhaps a biologist might have some more understanding of that than I would. Okay, moving on. From Brazil. Okay, from Brazil, is it possible to explain transgendered people in terms of karma and rebirth? Well, not really. For a start, if you are capable of recollecting your own past lives or the other past lives of others, you might be able to have a look at these things, right? I mean, if you say something's happened, right, and somebody says to you, well, that must be your karma, you should immediately get down on the floor and bow to them, okay? And say, wow, sadhu, 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 it's so amazing, you've developed your psychic powers to such an extremely high level that you can read my past lives and you know what happened to me and you can see what deed I did in the past and how that creates what happened in the future. Sadhu, 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 right? So, of course, that's probably not what's happening, right? So instead, what people do is that they use these words in this kind of meaningless way. I mentioned before in theistic religions, some people are very apt to say this is what God's will is. Well, how do you know what God's will is? Right? It's the same thing with karma and rebirth. You can say, well, this is their karma or something like that. And you can say, well, how do you know? Right? Karma, that's not the purpose of karma, right? The purpose of the teaching of karma is to understand what are good choices and what are bad choices, right? What are right ways of doing things and what are wrong ways of doing things. And so, and to understand that those choices have effects, right? That's all. If you do good things, you get good. If you do bad things, you get bad. Right? So it's not about trying to make some universal system that can just explain everything. All that does is explain everything away. Now, the other thing to bear in mind is that from a Buddhist point of view is that causality is complex, okay? And you can't, as a general principle, you can't really infer back from results to causes, okay? This is the thing that makes it hard, right? I mean, you think about something like lung cancer. I mean, we say, you know, cigarette smoking causes lung cancer, but you can't infer that because someone has lung cancer that they must have smoked, right? Because some people have lung cancer and they don't smoke, and some people smoke and they don't have lung cancer. So it's not 100%, it's not fixed. So in the same way, in terms of karma and so on, these things are not fixed. Karma is one force which is sort of generating the possibility of rebirth in different realms, but it doesn't determine everything that happens, and biology and all of these other conditions that are there also play a part. So yeah, I don't think that explaining it in terms of karma and rebirth is particularly useful. Okay. In the spirit of sexual orientation, should pedophilic or incestuous relationships also be tolerated? And that's from Sangat from the USA. Okay, so tolerated. Well, the problem, they're two rather different cases in terms of pedophilia. Obviously, you have a relationship which by its nature is non-consensual. And so it's always involves violence to some degree or a power play. And for that reason, it's not considered ethical under any circumstances, and it is something which is condemned in the suttas. So, no, I don't think that we should consider that with pedophilia. Incest is a rather different case, I think. If it's adults, incest is something which is a very deep taboo in all societies, and yet is probably far more common than we like to think. suttas don't give us any there are some things in the suttas on the topic. I don't want to go into it in too much detail, but I would say that my personal opinion would be that cases of incest should be... I'm not sure that it's healthy to deal with that from a legal point of view. I think it's probably going to be much saner and more sensible to address cases like that sort of socially or culturally by trying to help people rather than treating people like criminals. Obviously, again, just to say that's excluding cases of paedophilia where there is no consent possible. Okay, so that's those cases. Any other questions? Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for your talk tonight. It was very, very enjoyable and interesting. I just want to say that I've actually joined the gay and lesbian choir. I'm a heterosexual.
Are you in the closet there?
What I want to share. I actually revealed that I'm not gay, but I have lots of gay friends.
Okay.
And I was married to a crossdresser as well. So,
okay.
But I just want to say how much joy I feel with these beautiful people, because they're so incredible, and there's no discrimination against me because I'm not gay, that I'm a heterosexual. It's just wonderful. And it was just so great that you mentioned they sang in the...
Very, very nicely. It was great.
Oh, they're absolutely incredible. See, I also belong to the Buddhist choir.
Okay.
This is the SGI Buddhist choir. And it is so calm and so peaceful and so boring compared to... I hope they are listening to me tonight. But, thank you. thank you.
Okay, very good. Oh, nice. Good to know that they're still going. Yeah. That was a nice way to do that at that conference, because you do it in a way that's kind of fun and, you know, it's light, because sometimes these issues can get very heavy. So you just, you know, don't make an issue out of it, you know. Here they are, come and sing a song. It's good. Okay, very good. Looks like no more questions for this evening. So let's finish up by paying respects to the Triple Gem.